Welcome to InFlight Entertainment's Filmmakers Lounge. And today we have a very special guest, a very talented and extremely awesome independent filmmaker who I have the pleasure of knowing and worked with. I met this fellow in Austin during the Austin Revolution Film Festival. Shout out to James and everyone at ARF, you know, lots of love for you guys down there. I love ARF. And we just, you know, over the months and over the years, we stay connected. Like, we're right next door to each other, both kind of Burbank adjacent. I reached out to him. He's gracious enough to bless me with his presence of all of the knowledge that he has, far as, you know, getting his movie from script to now where we see it. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring to you Yonash Brennemann.
Hey, how are you, Yusuf? Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, of course, man. I had to get you on, man. It's so exciting when we talk. Like, for the people who don't know you yet, give us a little bio about yourself.
Oh, God. Talk about myself. my name's Yonash. End of story. Born in the Czech Republic. I was lucky enough to be locked in jail as a 2-year-old in communism. Came over here with a dream and a backpack, mainly because of mom, because at 2, I didn't really know too much. Basically, communism fell a year later. Was raised between Michigan and Czech. And after high school, came actually out to California with a demo CD because I used to be in a rock band, and slowly realized that people don't like to play real instruments anymore. Everything's done on a computer. So I was like, I need to restructure my path in life, and fell in love with acting, which in return led me to screenwriting and eventually developed into filmmaking. And music was puppy love, but filmmaking is true love.
Now, it sounds like just what you just gave us. That's a script in itself.
People say that, but at the same time, like, I don't know, I guess because it's my story, I don't find it as relevant. You know what I mean? Like, I think that anybody that goes through a certain thing in their lives, like, you can appreciate certain things. Like, I love everything that my mom ever did for me. You know, like, she literally chose to leave a communist country, and no matter, like, you know, the odds and everything. But for me personally, like, it's a story that maybe one day I'll love to tell. But right now, it's not the story that needs to be told, I guess, in my current state.
I mean, because I totally see, like, Ryan Gosling, you know, just like taking on this story and, you know, getting to L.A., having this band and going into filmmaking, you know, guys, like, come on, man, what's holding this story up? That's fine. No, that's awesome, dude. Awesome. Like I said, I met Yonash doing, I forgot which year, but I had a short that was accepted in Austin Revolution Film Festival.
It was Walk of Shame at the time.
Yes, it was Walk of Shame. Yes.
It was actually my directorial debut.
Oh, nice, nice, nice.
Yeah, I believe you and I the same year actually had our directorial debuts.
Yes, because I think for the shorts. Yes, I think Father Jayla, my first short, was down there. Right. Yeah. And then we were down there. We were chatting, drinking. It's, you know, that's kind of how it goes down there. At ARF. You compensate, you have fun, you have laughs, you have lots of drinks. And through our conversation, we found, like, oh shit, like, you're in Cali. You're in L.A.? When? Get out of here. Like, I'm not far from you. And the rest is history.
it took us a while to actually link up together to do something out here, but eventually it happened. So, you know, yeah. I think things happen when they're supposed to, for sure.
Exactly. So what inspired you to pursue filmmaking? Because you say you transitioned from music, Like, what was the bug? Was it something you seen or like something you read? It's just like that switch, like, you know what? Ah, I need to do this.
So to be honest, I've always loved acting, you know, like storytelling and all that kind of stuff. I mean, one, I was, you know, being raised basically, you know, crippled, you know, up until the age of seven, like, you know, I had, you know, four surgeries and on my feet, you know, so I was in an awful wheelchair and, you know, on a walker and all that kind of stuff. And honestly, like up until, you know, high school, like, I basically got picked on, didn't have a lot of friends, you know, and it was one of those things that I kind of just had to survive on my own. And we lived in the country, not even in, you know, the inner town, you know. So, I mean, I played Army Man all the time. And I had a lot of friends that weren't there. And, you know, obviously, you know, once I got into music and played football and all that kind of stuff, all of a sudden, it's just like, you know, popularity came. And I was like, you realize I grew up with all of you assholes, right? You know, so it's just like, I guess kind of like seeing, you know, seeing that transition of, you know, being that loner and then all of a sudden being like the popular kid, you know, that definitely, you know, had an impact on kind of, you know, when it comes to storytelling and, you know, being an actor and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I always felt that music was something that was phenomenal and great. And in the end, it's actually storytelling, you know, and my English teacher, he would always yell at me because I never took English seriously. And I slept half the time. Mm-hmm. And, he basically told me, he's, you know, you have an A+ in this class and you sleep all the time. I said, yeah, what's your point? I'm going to be a rock star. Leave me alone. And it wasn't until I moved out to LA that, you know, like I said, seeing music transition into, you know, it almost felt like it was coming into, you know, Europe in a way, because, you know, Europe is very much, when it comes to music, I believe a little further in the future when it came to electronica and people like really, you know, wanting to dance and go to nightclubs and all this kind of stuff. I mean, you're pretty much going to nightclubs and doing overnighters at 16 years old over there. You know, it's freaking ridiculous. I mean, I was an alcoholic before I turned 21, you know, and yeah, so really, you know, I think a lot of that had, you know, had kind of contributed to the fact, you know, becoming kind of that just storytelling vibe of, you know, seeing the world and having the history that my mom, you know, kind of instilled within me and, you know, the loneliness into popularity and then, you know, all that kind of stuff. And when I came out here, I went on a few auditions and the one thing that was consistent was the scripts were horrible.
No.
I would walk out of auditions and question, how are you getting money for this? So, you know, back in that day, I mean, there was definitely a lot of, you know, contributions of pot and it was very much, I could do this. So, you know, started kind of screenwriting and at first, like everybody, you know, it was complete fails. You know, you're reading it and going, this is atrocious. Right. And then you actually try to do, you know, like a short film or something like that. And it was just like, oh my God, this is terrible. I do not know how to do script to screen. You know, it looks good on paper, but then when you film it, you're just like, no, this is bad. And the first thing that really allowed me to see the writing aspect and more kind of like the visionary aspect was, I don't know if you ever saw it, but we did a show called Belligerent Drunks and Paranoid Stoners. It was a web series that I did.
No, you did. I know you held this for me.
Yeah, we did a 5-episode kind of in the vein of Always Sunny in Philadelphia about these two drunks and two stoners that are living together in LA trying to make it. And it's literally just the stupid antics. Like the first one is literally Operation Coitus, you know, and it's basically the drunks are trying to get laid. And, you know, the second episode is they lock themselves out of the house and it's literally the whole episode, them trying to break into their own home, you know? So it was super fun and it allowed me to put the director's cap on for the first time. But at that point, I was still very much acting. So it was kind of like acting, but directing where I kind of needed to, you know, push the story and whatever else. But it wasn't until Yeah, you know, after that series, started really taking writing more seriously and, you know, started writing drama. And I fell in love with dramatic, gritty dramas, you know, stuff like that, that really makes a person feel something. And from there, you know, fell into a depression, which, you know, thank goodness ended up turning, you know, upside. And it was art that actually saved me. You know, wrote a script called The Last Retreat, very close to my heart.
Which and, you still need to do. I mean, that story is amazing.
Thank you. And yeah, from there, you know, no one was going to trust me to direct something if you've never directed anything before. So you needed to start small. So ended up writing Walk of Shame. And it was a very personal piece because, you know, obviously not myself has went through that story. But, you know, I had a friend, you know, dear close friend of mine that basically, you know, kept a secret for years and finally, you know, came out with it. And I just really put myself kind of in that story and really would, you know, really tried to figure out the best way to tell it. And, you know, always wanting to kind of do that sleight of hand trick because, you know, through the film, a lot of people hated the female, you know, and I wanted that. That was the point. I wanted them to hate her for at the end to be like, oh my God, I am so sorry.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No. I mean, which, you know, and that's the best art, you know, is to not be afraid to put your main character in this position that is subject to give you like a subversive, you know, point of view, right? You know, it's like, all right, then that challenges you as, oh wow, like, damn, I think that way. Oh, why was I approaching like this judgmental like way? Like, is that a reflection of me? Like how I view the society? I mean, I love stuff. I love stories like that. You know, just the, you know, put the contradiction in your face. Like, yeah, like, you know, you were thinking that, like, don't, you know, you know, like, that's the stuff you need to deal with internally. Yeah. I definitely, you know, that's what I really dig about, you know, how you write your characters, how you write your stories, you know, how you convey certain moments with your characters that's a springboard for a bigger conversation. I guess that's the word. That's the saying. But yeah. So, okay. So what's your creative, I guess what's your creative regimen? Right. Okay. Meaning that what sparked you to tackle a specific story or it like, yeah. Like, what's the thing that gets you like, okay, you know what? I want to do something about this particular subject or this particular character or this particular thing.
So honestly, as of right now, it's mainly being the fact of, I guess you could say, knowing where the market is. You know, sadly to say, you know, because it used to be very much a see what sticks with you, see what kind of, you know, won't go away after 2 weeks of being in your mind. Because I'm very much, I don't know. I think there's two types of writers. I think there's your writer that, you know, sleeps with a notebook by their bedside. And then there's the other writer that kind of lets it sink in. And until it actually makes sense, they don't put words to paper, you know, and I'm that type of writer. You know, I have nothing against being the type of person to, you know, jot notes and whatever else. But for me, I'm like, I will remember the idea a week or 2 weeks from now if it still sits with me. You know, and there's a difference between when an idea first comes to you and an idea that you're working on. If it's an idea that you're working on, then I fullheartedly believe anytime you think of something for that idea, punch it in your phone, you know, write it down or whatever else. But when it's that first initial conception of an idea, don't force it. But if it's something that won't go away, it's kind of like going to the store and finding that, you know, like that shirt that you like, or let's say the video game that you want, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, right. And you're just sitting there going, do I really want this? Do I really need this? You know, you walk away, you sit on it, and then a couple of days later, fuck it, I need it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's funny. I love getting this conversation from other filmmakers just to see how it materialized. Because with me, again, I'm with you. I have to let the germ of the idea stew. And then after so long, and it's funny with me, oddly, like I think about the story, I think about the character, I think about the characters. And my eureka moment, oddly, is if I see how it ends in my mind, then it's like, okay, this is something I need to do. And then, I don't know, for me it's odd because it's like reverse engineering. And like if I can envision how the story ends,
yeah,
like, if I see an end point to this idea, then like, oh, okay, then I can kind of work my way to the catalyst, which I don't know if that makes sense, but yeah, so that's kind of like my mad way of like figuring out a story. And like you said, if that's the shirt I need to like go back to the store to buy or not buy. But I always find that fascinating with other filmmakers, you know, how they grasp the idea. Okay, right. This is worth my time, stress, effort, like hairs falling out to, you know, get this thing done. Yeah.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. Sometimes you literally will throw up on a page. I can't tell you how many times, you know, we've been watching something on TV and I'm getting ready to fall asleep. And all of a sudden this thing hits me where it's literally a waterfall coming down from the heavens. And I will get out my phone and I'm like, trying to keep up with whatever, you know, is there. And I look at it the next day, and that's a very big difference from waking up from a dream. Because I'll tell you what, I don't know about you, but anytime that I've woken up from a dream and tried to jot down what it was, as brilliant of an idea as it was, when I finally got my morning coffee and all right, let's see what it is. A Nazi trumpet dog. That's the thinker.
Yeah. It's like, what did I eat last night to make me think of that? Oh, yeah, no, but you're absolutely right. Yeah, sometimes it's just bleh, and sometimes it's like, oh, let me just let me hold it close to see if it births in my head movies, an actual movie. yeah, that's awesome, man. All right, so let's get into The Death of Us, man. So tell us about your journey, man. Your inspiration for it, getting all the pieces together, you know, and where we are now with it.
So Death of Us was very much a product of circumstance, I guess. Me and Aku, we work for the same studio, and we both simultaneously lost our job on the same day. March 15th. And we spent 2 weeks drinking, doing the Netflix, you know, constantly in a circle and whatever else. And simultaneously, you know, we had met Dana in January. So after this all fell, you know, it was kind of just like, okay, you know, we had already done like a short film together and whatever else. So the creative mindset was kind of already there, but we didn't really know how far it was going to really go. But, you know, after 2 weeks of the world shut down and everything else, I kind of got bored. Mm-hmm. I was like, the world shut down. Nah, I'm bored of this. Like, I think right now is a opportunity taker. You know, you either sit at home and let it pass, or you take the opportunity given to you. And me personally, you know, leading up to it, I had been saying for months, I said, I don't have the time, nor do I have the money to make a feature film. But give me one of these and I can do it. I either need the money or I need the time. So You're welcome. COVID happened because of me, because all of a sudden I got the time.
Fauci would love you.
You know, so yeah, I want to say probably April 1st or April 2nd. You know, it sounds better if it happens on April 1st, because it kind of felt like an April Fool's joke to everybody. Mm. When I walked up to him and I said, hey, let's make a movie. Aku goes, yeah, okay, so a short film. Now let's do a feature. Get the fuck out of here. All right. You know, I went and talked to Dana. I was like, hey, we should do a feature. She's like, a short film though, right? I
said, like a short film.
That's not a feature.
A feature is like short, right?
You're fucking nuts. I said, okay. So I ended up hitting up my writing partner and I said, hey, we should do something. And he goes, I absolutely agree. We should take advantage of this time. Let's go through and rewrite some of our old scripts. And I said, or what if we wrote a new script? And he goes, I like that idea. Who knows how long we'll be locked down? And I was like, and bonus, we film it. And he's like, what? You are crazy. I said, I mean, am I though? Like, I got a camera, I got sound gear, I got a couple of Home Depot lights. I said, we have the sun, like some bounce boards. We got everything we need. Let's do this. And yeah, everyone kind of called me crazy for a few days, but they came back a couple days later. And everyone kind of said, if we were to do a feature, what do you have in mind? And I was like, huh, well, let's not do anything pandemic related. And then we ended up going pandemic related.
I mean, it sells itself. Yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, you know, we went through a couple of ideas. Like at first, you know, having you know, Dana and Aku, you know, the first idea was obviously let's do a home invasion movie. But what if it's the girl invading the man? You know, we're like, that would be a great idea. And then we started thinking about it. We're just like, ah, man, I hate to say it, but like we should lean into this pandemic thing because there is so much guerrilla footage we could capture. Right. And that was honestly the decision maker. It was very much a let's go out into public and let's see what we can capture. And I remember one of our first shots that we got was Hollywood Boulevard, completely empty. There wasn't a single car. There wasn't a single person. And to get that shot, you know, the people that are outside of Hollywood don't understand. That's $1 million shot. Yes. To shut down fucking Hollywood Boulevard. Yes. You know, and for us to be able to capture that just hanging out of a car, please don't crash.
Yeah, that was brilliant. And you know what's so awesome about that is it captures it's one of those things you can put in, you know, what's it called? A time capsule movie, yeah. Right? You know, it's like you were saying, you're never going to see anything replicated like what you shot, which was in real time, which was in the moment of what we were going through, which is the pandemic. So it was really ingenious that you know, you and your crew, you know, took advantage of just the desolate nature of LA.
That was
really smart. That was really cool. Well, give us a little bit on the synopsis. What's the death of us all about?
So the death of us, what we ended up basically making the story is two friends that are locked inside their home experiencing lockdown together, except in our dystopian future, martial law actually does take place. The government does shut down everybody. And when they say stay at home orders, they're actually meaning do not leave your home or you will be shot on sight. And I don't want to give too much away, but it's kind of one of those stories that, you know, the first act very much is what we all went through. And then the second and third act is what we all hoped would never come.
Right. Yeah. It definitely is a little, when I watched it, was a little too close for comfort. Given, like you said, given, because you really captured
the escalation of, you know, through the news reports, through, you know, on the medical end with the hospitals, you know, with your character. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, like that's what was happening. That's what people were going through, like the loss of work, loss of jobs. Oh, and let me ask you this. Okay. There's a scene with a horse. So did y'all have any resistance? Like, cause I see, like, it was like that scene where the horse is like, right, you know, just riding up the street with no issues. Yeah. Was that one of those, like, thanks, COVID? Like, police ain't gonna be like giving us crap if we just ride this horse up the street. Like, with the horse.
So the cool thing is, actually, the horse itself wasn't an issue, nor would it even be an issue. The bigger issue was the fact that we were filming it, because here in Burbank, in this little area, you know, there's horses up and down the street. There's actually horse crossing signs, you know, everywhere. So, you know, that was definitely to our benefit. And, you know, being able to kind of, you know, like I said, with this story, you kind of wrote what was at your disposal, you know, right. Like we were able to really expunge the most value using everything that we had. You know, it was basically, you know, having the horse, you know, having the ability to use a horse. We knew right away. We're like, one of the characters has to ride a horse.
Exactly.
You know, having, you know, the town shut down. It was like, okay, well, we have to go into town. You know, we have to have a freak out moment, because how many times, you know, you had these people that were just absolutely petrified of going into the store. I mean, I can't tell you how many times it didn't affect me. I never really had a fear that COVID was going to do anything to me, you know, but I know that to some people it did, you know, and that's why we wrote the story with a very yin and yang perspective. You know, you had one character that was the extremely deathly afraid. And then you had the one character that was very just like, this is going to pass. Like, what makes this different from anything else? You know, and we really leaned into it, you know, and the one character we knew for a fact, we wanted to have that because, you know, I had thought about actually going into the store and doing the gorilla thing, which I probably could have gotten away with. But I said, what if the person doesn't even make it into the store? You know, how much more powerful is it for them to literally, you know, putting on the alcohol, putting on gloves, and then putting on the alcohol on the gloves? You know, like that's how paranoid some people got, you know, and the second that, you know, she opens the door and it's just reality kicks in and city life just completely takes her over and she decides, fuck this, I ain't going to the store. You know?
Yeah.
Really, really capturing those kind of moments that I know certain people had was definitely something that had to be in this film. Yeah. You know, and the same thing with like the whole claustrophobia aspect, you know, that was another decision that was made, you know, early on in the filmmaking process, mainly because of how we did it, because we were writing it and filming it at the same time. So we didn't actually know exactly where the story was going, but it's kind of in the first act, you know, I ended up shooting very wide. And I wanted everything to kind of like capture from the outside. But the further and further we get into the story, I saw myself closing in. And at first it was an accident, but then I really leaned into it. So by the third act, the camera is very much in, you know, the characters' faces.
Yeah.
And if you take, you know, the first scene and then, you know, the last couple of scenes, you'll really see that. Mm-hmm. And I had friends, which, you know, was an absolute wonderful compliment. They were like, your story made me feel claustrophobic by the end. And I said, perfect. That's exactly what we wanted to do.
Right. Yeah. So just like the situation that was going on, you know, during the time pandemic, everyone was feeling claustrophobic. They couldn't go out. They couldn't physically be with the people they want to be with, like their friends, things like that. But yeah, so like, yeah, it was amazing, you know, visually how, like I said, things just start squaring in and just getting tighter and tighter and tighter. Now, like awesome, like, you know, ensemble, you know,
cast, everything. But we have to mention the unsung hero of this particular film.
Oh, it's a big drum.
Which Aquanetta the drum. Now, let me give people a backstory on this. So, Jonas texts. He's like, "Hey man, like you still have that drone, right?" I was like, "Yeah, I'm still rocking." It's like, "Oh, like can you go through? Like, I need a couple of drone shots for this feature I'm doing." I'm like, "Oh, yeah, dude, yeah, of course, yeah." So you know. Yeah, we did the run through. I was zooming the drone left, right, up, down, doing dive bombs with it on top of the house and almost hitting the house, everything. It was fun. Like I said, we kept it safe. You know, we were all safe. Just let everybody know, like, you know, we kept it safe and everything. Everyone was good. But it was really fun. Like doing it, because it was like, wow, that's what, you know, we used to do. Like, we used to like make stuff. We used to like do the filmmaking stuff. We used to do the independent stuff. We would call up everybody, "Hey, yo, I'm feeling something. I need your help. Come on over," kind of thing. You know? But it was refreshing, and I definitely walked away with, "Oh, okay, cool." Like, I kind of needed that. I kind of needed to like be on a set and interacting, you know, and just bouncing off the, you know, the creative energy of other people, something that we weren't doing when we were locked down. So,
yeah, because we hit you towards the end of our filming. So you had been probably going stir crazy for a good 2 months at this point.
yes, that's why I was like, "Cool, I'll swing over," you know, once it was going to. So Aquanetta the drone has a cameo, and I salute you for putting her in the credits.
Hey, absolutely. When I literally asked, "Hey, how can I repay you for, you know, seriously doing us this huge favor?" And that was literally the stipulation. Yeah. Credit to Aquanetta. And I said, "Okay, there's got to be something else. Like, can we get beers once this all this bullshit's over?" Yes, we'll do the credit thing, but
we'll do the credit thing, but it was cool, and yeah, it was definitely fun. Like, I know it was probably about to a couple hours or so, you know, I contribute, which for me, I'm like, I mean, it wasn't much, but I'm glad I was able to help.
It was fun. And the thing is, it was absolutely necessary. You know, it's kind of one of those, honestly, the way that I look at the drone, especially for this film, was it was very much the celebrity that you paid $10,000 for the day, and you only have one day to shoot with them. So you're like, "What can we get done while we have them?"
That's hilarious. Oh goodness. Yeah. Well, I mean, like, that was, yeah, it was good. And how you use the shots and how you incorporate the footage and the stalking nature of, you know, the big brother like element of the story, right? Yeah. along with, you know, the wait a minute, did I do the voice on that too?
The voice.
Oh my god.
I love how you're talking about the drone and you forgot you voiced the drone too.
Oh wow, yeah. That's crazy. That was fun too. Oh yeah, you're right. I did do it, because I remember you text like, "Oh yeah, is it possible you can maybe do like a robotic voice and say these lines?" You know, it's like, okay,
I believe the exact reference was, can you redo the X-Men robot voice from the cartoon series? And I forgot it's
the Sentinels.
The Sentinels, there we go.
Which is fun. I was like, yeah, I'll see what I can do. I'll see what I can play with. I mean, I want to have like a robotic voice, see how my voice sounds with that. Oh, wow. Yeah. So it was cool. And it was awesome, especially, you know, when you're doing, you know, independent filmmaking, especially what you, you know, with The Death of Us, like, there's so many, you know, there's a couple of familiar faces you know, in your movie. I'm like, oh, okay, oh, Steph. Oh, you know, I haven't seen him in a while. Like, oh, Young Nash pulled him. Oh, that's cool. Which is good. It's just kind of like the camaraderie within, you know, independent filming. It's like, oh, yeah, like, everyone just a comic go, like, have a way we can help whatever resources, what have you, you know? Yeah, just, you know, just to keep it pushing forward. And that was that. That was really good. And I'm really happy to see the finished product. And yeah, it was great.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, right. It's definitely scared to finally get it out there. But, you know, people's reactions that have seen it have been really great. So
yeah, that was awesome. All right. So I'll ask you this question. So this is a fill in the blank. The filmmaking would have been less challenging if someone would have told me blank.
Filmmaking would have been a lot less challenging if they would have told me blank.
Yeah, someone would have told me blank.
That money doesn't grow on trees. No, honestly, I don't think there's anything anyone can tell you. And that has nothing to do with, you know, arrogance or, you know, confidence or anything like that. Because how many times have you been told something and it doesn't click until it clicks? You know what I mean? It's you always kind of have your own path, you know, especially if you're going to be a filmmaker and if you're going to be a director and you're taking the helm of a ship. You are willing to hear many people, but hearing is definitely different than actually absorbing the information that is given, you know? And I truly believe that, you know, as a filmmaker, I was told a long time ago, you know, write what you know. Mm-hmm. And I looked at that producer and I was like, you're an asshole. What the fuck does that mean? I'm writing what I know. Otherwise, you wouldn't have words on a script to read right now. And honestly, it took eight years for me to finally realize what she meant by that. Mm. And like I said, it's one of those things that nobody can truly tell you anything while you're doing your thing. You know, there's things that are going to help you along the way, but until it clicks, it won't make sense.
That's a great answer. I mean, well, in like maybe in context of, I don't know, we could break down the different phases of production, right? Like, if someone told me blank about, you know, right? If someone would tell me blank about the production, if someone would have told me blank about the post, if someone would tell me blank about, you know, marketing and distributing and stuff like that. It's like, you know, like.
So when it comes to stuff like distribution and whatever else and marketing, those are definitely things that you can't figure out on your own, because in all honesty, you can find creative ways to market, but there are not ways to market without being creative. Does that make sense? So it's like when it comes to things that already have an algorithm set in its own place, you really can't, you know, kind of shade from that. You know, you kind of have to listen to the rules. But when it comes to writing, you know, yeah, if someone would have told me about formula, you know, how many years ago, then yeah, of course, I would have been a way better writer from the get-go. But the thing is, I was told about formula when I first started. And I was like, fuck you. Why am I going to listen to something that's been done a billion times? I'm going to do it my way.
Right. Plus, you're going to be a rock star.
Exactly. You know, and it's not until you actually become a very much, you know, traditional, you know, fall into the gap of I'm going to be a writer that you're like, formula's kind of important. Mm-hmm. You know, and like I said, that's something that was told to me from day one. Mm-hmm. Oh, you want to be a writer? Read this book, this book, this book, this book. I'm like, yeah. Or I just write the story that I want to see. Well, yeah, your story is going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And the premise, here's the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. You can be great at constructing an incredible premise. But if you don't know how to execute it, it's a shit story. Mm. You know? And I think you know that as much as I do. It's one of those things that if you have the best premise in the world and it's not done properly, it's gonna be shit. Plain and simple. There is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You know? Right. So that's where formula comes in. You need to be able to fit within this already structured, basically it's the Bible of writing. you have to tell your story within this because it's been around for thousands of years.
Right. Yeah, exactly. What they say, like, know the rules so you know how to bend or break them.
Exactly.
Right. Oh, great. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm with you, man. I hear 160%.
You know, yeah. And then when it comes to directing, you know, like, what would you possibly, you know, want to know that, you know, the biggest thing is knowing how to maintain your cool. You know, I think the biggest thing as a human being that I've learned differently from being a director is definitely patience. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that, like, as a human, I can lose my cool very easily. But when I'm directing, I found that because I'm creating art, it's something that's so beautiful that you try to figure out the best way to tell your actor something, you know? Right. And yeah, that's definitely kind of the key for, you know, directors. Like, these directors that end up being assholes and just, like, yelling on set and all that kind of stuff, I never understand that, because I'm just like, you get to play in Neverland every single day. Like, why are you going to get pissed off? Okay. Just figure out how to say this information to the person that you're trying to tell it to, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I say, everyone are willing bodies, and all you, assuming that everyone is locked in on a common goal to deliver the best product, because why are everyone together to do said project? Right. So, yeah. Right. So with that, there's a realization of cooperation, right, within, you know, the actors. So like they wouldn't be here if they're not trying to do their best work, you know. Yeah. Meaning that they're willing to, like, listen to you, the director, to, if there's anything you need to bring out of them, anything you want them to do a little more, you know, like, you know, notches, you know. Like you said, the problem is some people don't really know how to convey or properly convey what they need out of, you know, performers, you know. Then, like you said, they get pissed off, like, that's not what I meant. That's not what I, you know, you're a terrible actor, you know, like
yeah. You can never do that, because all you're going to do is, you know, you're basically sinking the anchor further into the water, you know, at that point. You know, it's when you're trying to get something out of your actor and they don't deliver exactly what you want, you know. Yeah, you can get pissed off, you can get peeved or whatever, but never let them see it. You know, you need to keep your cool, and you need to look at them and say, hey, that was great. But what if we tried it this way, you know? Yeah. And sometimes they'll give you the exact same performance and you just have to go, that was fantastic. But can we try it this way? You're saying the same exact thing, just with different verbiage, and you're hoping that they get it.
You're like, okay, that was great. Oh, you know what would be really cool for the next take? You know, like, how I'm excited to do something that you actually want them to do. Oh, yeah.
It's so hard also having, like, kind of that acting background, because to do line reading is terrible. You should never do that. But you kind of want to go, yeah, but you need to say it kind of like this.
Yeah, the whole juggling act, man. Most definitely. Yeah, but, you know, you managed to, you know, get the performance that you need out of, like, everyone, all willing participants, especially with, you know, the death of us. And it shows, you know, it was definitely a well executed, well thought out, and I mean, suspenseful at times. Yeah, I mean, it was a great presentation, man. So in closing, last
Any last words, thoughts, and also plug this movie so people can see this movie. You know, people have to check this out.
So The Death of Us is available on Amazon Prime. It's available on Vudu. It's available on Tubi. Yeah, obviously Prime and Vudu are going to be, rentals or purchases. Tubi, you can watch it with commercials. That's how, eventually the film generates money by playing these wonderful little 15-second to 30-second segments. And in closing, when it comes to it, like seriously, as an independent filmmaker, like don't let anything ever stand in your way. You know, I had told myself so many times in so many years, just like, no, you got to wait for the money or you got to wait for the right time and all this kind of stuff. Honestly, things can be pieced together just by having that motivation, and nothing should stop you. This film was, done on a camera that, is normally used for photography. And, the lighting was, lights that you buy at Home Depot, so you don't need all these grandiosa kind of things to make it work. You make it work by having the eye and knowing properly framing things. And, you just need to know the basics of the things that you are working with. Not everyone's granted with the blessing of having, a red camera or any other, big fashion toy that, people talk about. Sometimes you just have to go out there and do it. And as an independent filmmaker, that's definitely the one thing that, you just need to find people that are willing to support your cause. And the second that you get everyone else to believe in you is when, you need to lastly believe in yourself.
Well said, brother. Well said. Well, thank you so much for taking time to come by the Filmmakers Lounge to talk about The Death of Us. Everyone seek out this movie. It's an awesome display of a filmmaker taking destiny in his own hands and making what he wants to make, and the finished product is something really great. And we appreciate you, Yoash, and I can't wait for the next feature you do, and you're gonna come back and talk about that one too.
Oh, absolutely, Yusuf, anytime. And yeah, we just got to keep on kicking, and I'm excited to see your new upcoming stuff as well.
Yeah, me too. Got some stuff cooking, but we'll see what happens. This is Yusuf. This is In Flight Entertainment's Filmmakers Lounge, and we wish everyone peace. I want to say peace.
Thanks so much, guys.
Peace.